Kelsey Shipman, welcome to Dirtbag Rich.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
You reached out to me online and you said, I keep thinking that I'm going to find one place to live, work, and settle down, but I always get bored and leave the country again. I'm starting to reluctantly admit that I'm one of those weirdos who needs to be free to travel and make art in order to be fulfilled in life. That hooked me. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think, I feel that I've had to explain myself to people a lot. When I was 19, I studied abroad in West Africa. And for some people who come from families who travel a lot or come from immigrant families, this would be no big deal. I stayed in a dorm in a university. I had a scholarship to go. You know, I worked a summer job, saved up for a plane ticket, and I attended classes for 6 months. But for me, I come from a pretty old Texas family. My mom's family is mostly from Fort Worth these days, but my mother group was from a very small town in West Texas. And my family just didn't travel very much. And the idea that their daughter, I was the oldest daughter, the oldest granddaughter, I was the first kid in the family, that I wanted to go to West Africa for 6 months, freaked everybody out. I mean, everybody thought I was crazy. I remember my mom driving me to the airport and she was crying. She was sending me through security because she literally thought I was never going to come home. And I was just on a study abroad program. So from a young age, I always felt like I had to explain myself. Why did I want to go to West Africa? Why did I want to? My first degree was in philosophy. My second degree is in poetry. Just because I love books. And my dad is like a software engineer. And he's like, why are you studying old books? You know? And so there's this sense of that I always felt like I was doing something wrong. And then I started traveling abroad and meeting other expats. And when I say expats, I'm just going to be really clear. Like, I'm talking about mostly white people from Europe, Australia, and the States who go and live in largely impoverished countries. Now, that doesn't cover the whole realm of expats, but that is what the word, the connotation of the word is. And expats are weird people, man. They're like, they're super, they're weirdos. Like, they love, there's some kind of adrenaline hook, you know, I think similar to like rock climbers or people who walk tightropes across skyscrapers. There's some degree of that when you live in another country. So they're kind of weird. So even though I was like, I really like living abroad and it was feeding me in a lot of ways, I didn't want to identify with a lot of the people that I found myself around. So I kept resisting it. There was some deep part of me that was like, I'm doing something wrong because I keep wanting to live in different countries and I keep pursuing writing. And then there was this other part of me that was like, I'm around all these people who are doing what I'm doing, but I'm not like them. I feel different from them. So I'm almost 40. I just turned 39 last week. And it's taken me since I started traveling at 19. So I'm 20 years of traveling. It's taken me this long to be like, okay, this is who I am. This is just who I am. But like, I can't deny it. I can't pretend I'm going to be happy living in the suburb of Austin somewhere, or even the Pacific Northwest, or even Brooklyn. Like, I'm someone who I have to get out. I just have this perpetual need to get out. And frankly, if I'm not writing, I'm miserable. Like, there's just, you know, I was a teacher for 15 years and I love teaching and I really got a lot from it, but I never felt satisfied because I didn't have enough time to write. And the way that I personally have been able to engineer time, largely unpaid time in my life to write, is through living abroad.
There's so much I want to unpack here. First of all, I think you and I are similar in that if we're not writing and we're not moving around and experiencing different places, different geographies, we are pretty miserable. And I'm wondering what the origin of that feeling of misery is for you. So what does it feel like when you feel stuck or when you feel like you don't have a new horizon or a new culture to experience when you are in the proverbial suburb of Austin for too long?
Yeah, good question. Well, let's get deep here. You know, in the 20 years I've been traveling, it's also 20 years of doing therapy and investigating myself and answering these questions. And I know that for me, I had a really weird upbringing. I had a lot of people can understand people's lives who come from two different cultures. Their father's from Senegal, their mother's from Uruguay, or, you know, they have a mother from urban New York City and a father from the boonies in Western Pennsylvania. But even though my family were all white Texans, like eight generations of Texans, I grew up with a big class divide. I had a really divergent experience of class, which also kind of fell in line with politics. So my mother was a nurse. For most of my childhood, she lived in a trailer in a tiny town in West Texas and never had any money, was perpetually in debt, but loved Mexican music, Mexican folk music, loved, she took in all the stray animals that would show up at her door. She had incredible gardens. I remember she had this mint garden that was like chocolate mint, orange mint, lemon mint. And as a, a fifth, sixth grader, it just blew my mind. Her partner had a fireworks stand on this 1 acre of land that they lived on, and they sold fireworks. And I spent 10 years working in the fireworks stand helping them. And so she was working class, the very edge of working class and lower middle class. And she was a leftist, she protested at city council meetings. She, had a lot of gay friends unapologetically, which at the time, this was like 80s and 90s in Austin. Sorry, this is outside Dallas at this point. That was unusual, And so my mother was a liberal in the middle of like redneck country. What we at the time we would have said Bush country. That's what I thought of it as. Now you might call it Trump country. So for me, I always associated, people who wanted to help other people. I associated people who were interested in other cultures, and I associated leftists and liberals with working class people. And then the other part of my life was with my dad. And my dad, he worked in corporations his whole life, or most of his life. He was a Republican. He worked lived We lived in a big house in the suburbs of Dallas. My dad liked money. He liked to spend money. And he was not a generous, open-minded, kind of loving person like my mom was. He was much more closed off, as I think a lot of men of his generation are, to be fair, just not very emotional, couldn't talk about feelings, and just not very affectionate. So even though as an adult, I've been able to unpack all those pieces, and I know that, not all Republicans are mean people, and I know that not all working class people, are leftists, but that is a really fundamental divide. Just in my psyche that I grew up with. And so I always felt out of place in both worlds. When I'd work at the fireworks stand with my mom, people would, these are all working class people who've been saving up money for a long time to buy fireworks, which last a couple hours if you're lucky. And, I would have a CD, like a Walkman CD player, and I'd be listening to it when there wasn't a lot of customers. And they would make comments about the rich girl from the suburbs. My own mother would call me spoiled because my dad had given me this Walkman. There was just a lot of comments that I was out of place because I came from a rich place. And the same thing was true in reverse. But during most of the school year, I'd stay in my dad's house in these rich, largely white suburbs. And I would go to school, and my friends had just spent, spring break in Paris. Or they were driving. I mean, I saw some article a few years ago about some high school girl from my high school who drove a $500,000 Lamborghini to school and parked it in the high school parking lot. And, I wasn't even, I think when I graduated college, my best friend gave me her 1989 Buick Century, and I paid her mom $1 for it to take it to college. So I was like the poor girl in the rich suburb, and I was the rich girl in the poor country town. And I just grew up never feeling like I fit in anywhere. And I think part of that is what makes me feel comfortable in other countries where I'm not supposed to fit in.
Okay, and what other countries have you lived in? Where have you been an expat?
Yeah, so I studied in West Africa in college, and then I went back after college for 6 or 8 months, and I worked at a university there. So Ghana and West Africa is definitely a really important place to me. I also studied abroad in Bolivia 1 semester. That's where my Spanish, I really cemented my Spanish. And then in graduate school, I did a writing program that was only 3 months in Czech Republic. Then after that, I lived in New York City for 2.5 years, which it's the same country, but it feels like a different country than rural Texas, I have to
Yes.
say. So I kind of felt like an expat in Brooklyn, I'll admit. And then with and then I, with my husband, I went to Uzbekistan, and we were international teachers in Tashkent for 2 years. And then we moved to San Miguel de Allende in Mexico at the start of this year.
Yeah, and we're going to circle back and talk about Mexico. First, tell me how you met your husband.
Well, like many millennials, we met online. And everyone calls it online dating, but I really feel like it's online meeting. You just find people you are interested in having a cup of coffee with. And so we met in Austin at a Greek restaurant. And yeah, the rest was history. We were both in our early 30s. We each had long-term relationships previously, but no marriages and no kids. And he's like me. I mean, he lived in France, he lived in Italy. He's a kind of a Europhile. His grandparents were from Europe. So he traveled all the time too. He was a teacher, he was also a musician. So we just had a lot in common. But you know what's really funny about that is that when I met him at the beginning of a school year, I think like August. And the following school year, he was trying to go teach abroad and he was applying for all these different international schools. And, we were dating, we were hanging out more and more. I was starting to fall in love with him, and he was asking me to edit his cover letters and edit his resumes. And after a couple months of this, I was like, what am I doing? I'm falling in love with you and I'm helping you leave me. I'm not helping you with your cover letters anymore.
Nice try, buddy. How about we go to Uzbekistan instead?
I know. And then that's true. And then like a year or two later, we ended up going abroad together as a couple.
So tell me about your work and your career. You said you've been an educator. You've also done writing and kind of get us up to speed to where you are right now.
Yeah, so that's pretty much how I think of myself as a writer and educator. I was a teacher for 15 years, and I've taught in public schools, private schools, international schools, colleges, universities, and I taught in the county jail outside of Austin for 5 years. And that being a teacher really fed me in a lot of ways. I feel like it healed a lot of childhood wounds because, not to toot my own horn, but I was a very beloved teacher, and both my husband and I have won Teacher of the Year multiple times. And so being loved by 100 kids a year, I don't know if it inflates your self-worth or it sort of, it helped me heal some wounds that I was still working on from childhood, I think. So it really served me. But like I said, I was never fully satisfied because we did not get paid very much as public school teachers. So I had to work every summer and I just didn't have enough time to write. So I also, during that period of time, I also was doing some freelance writing. I earned a master's in poetry and I started publishing a lot of my poems. I also was a spoken word artist, so I was performing my poems while I was also publishing them. And so a lot of what I've taught has been related to writing, creative writing, or intro to college writing, stuff like that. And then I had a baby. God, she's almost three at the end of this year. Is really crazy, but I had a baby and I was like, okay, I don't have any more bandwidth for other people's children because my child is taking up a lot of my time and my energy, and I just didn't really want to go back into the classroom. So I started figuring out what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to make enough money? How am I going to work on just like 20 hours a week, sometimes less? And it was a real kind of research project to figure out my skills, my interests, the stress level, what I want to do. And I landed on ghostwriting. And so for the last almost 3 years, I've been pursuing ghostwriting.
And for those who don't know what ghostwriting is, can you just quickly tell everyone?
Yeah, so ghostwriting is when you pay a writer to write something for you. It could be a book, it could be LinkedIn posts, it could be blog articles. But as the writer, my name is not on the piece of writing. It's the author's name. But I get paid for my time. So there's lots of famous ghost-written books. I mean, there's lots of academic discussion about Ulysses Grant's memoirs being written or heavily edited by Mark Twain. JFK's book that won a Pulitzer Prize was ghostwritten, largely ghostwritten, by one of his former speechwriters. Just virtually any politician or celebrity who has a book out, that was a ghostwritten book where you don't see the writer's name anywhere, but the writer got paid for their time and their expertise to write the book.
So who have you ghostwritten for? You probably can't name names, but what kind of people?
Great question. Yeah. Well, a big thing that comes along with ghostwriting are NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, because a lot of people don't necessarily want others to know that they hired a writer to write their book. But so I've done lots of different projects. I would say I've mostly focused on memoirs and cookbooks. Those are kind of the two types of books I really like to write. So I've written a memoir for a guy who served in the military. He was a career military officer employee, and he was also kind of a computer genius, and he came up with these kind of revolutionary procedures, technical procedures to do things in the Air Force. And I read his memoir, and that was really fun. I worked on a book for a Microsoft executive. I worked on a book for a radio host. And I've worked on a number of book proposals for cookbooks, and I'm in the middle of one right now for two sake industry experts in California and New York. And yeah, I really love memoir, and cookbooks more and more are vehicles of memoir. You know, yes, they have recipes and there's this technical element, but people are always telling their stories through food, you know?
It's so incredibly niche that you are writing not necessarily books, but book proposals for sake industry experts in the United States. It just shows what a world we live in.
Well,
So,
you know, it's because I like other cultures. I feel more comfortable in intercultural environments. And so when I have an opportunity to work on a book that, you know, ex explicates or elevates or innovates on a particular culture's food or cuisine or drink, I just jump at the chance because I really enjoy it.
how much do you work per week on average these days?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I have a 2-year-old who's almost 3, and that I have to and want to be available for her, so that takes up a chunk of my time. And then because a lot of my work is project based, it kind of ebbs and flows. So I would say on average it's probably 20 hours a week, maybe 15, but there are some weeks when I work 30 hours and there are some weeks when I work 2 hours, you know.
I love the magic number 15 hours a week. I feel like that's
Yeah.
what we should all aim for. What about your husband? Does he have a similarly flexible work schedule like
Yeah.
you?
Yeah, so he's a teacher, but he's always taught engineering and computer science and graphic design. So when we moved to Mexico, he got a remote position doing 20 hours a week for a startup in Austin and just doing some of their tech work. And then he also does some teaching. But you know, for him, like teaching is not just a job. You know, teaching is something that feeds him, like how writing feeds me. And so he works more now. He works closer to 30 hours a week now, sometimes a little more. But the teaching piece of that, what he gets from it is more than money. I don't know if that makes sense. So, you know, it's like he has an hourly job that's 20 hours a week with a startup, and he likes the people. He really enjoys the people he works with there. But the work itself is not particularly fulfilling. And then he does teaching on top of that, and it feeds him. I mean, he can be on, and it's all online because, of course, he's teaching in the US and we're in Mexico. But he'll, after being on Zoom for 4 hours, he'll come downstairs and he'll be like giddy. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? You've been sitting in a chair, like dealing with middle schoolers in Georgia for 4 hours. And he's like, I don't know, it's just really fun. I just like it.
Okay, so he clearly derives some purpose
Yeah.
from the teaching, and then doing the 20 hours a week for the tech startup is more to pay the bills, it seems.
Yeah, I would say so. And it's, you know, he's learning a lot, gaining more skills, but, you know, it's, yeah, I think that's a job, and teaching is more than that for him.
And it sounds like you are doing pretty well on the purpose or meaning metric also, because you seem to really enjoy ghostwriting memoirs and cookbooks, but you also still have some time to do your own writing. Can you just talk about your own writing, your personal writing, and
Sure.
what you take away from that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think all writers are in this, you know, are answering this perpetual question. Maybe you are too. You should tell me is, you know, how do I get what I need from writing? Because publishing is a tough industry, whether you're publishing with traditional publishers or you're self-publishing, there's a lot of work you have to do that is not writing the book. And you know, for me, I use a lot of my writing skills it through with the ghostwriting, but I also really love that too. But so sometimes at the end of the day, it's like I have to be selective about my own writing and what I do. So I've done a lot of freelancing this last year or two where I've tried out food writing, and I've written articles about chocolate producers in Mexico or the benefits of sake and how particularly it's a good drink for parents to when parents want to relax and have a drink at the end of the night or the week. You know, how the things that you get from sake and why sake is the good choice. I've written about the publishing industry. I've written about being a ghostwriter. I just turned in an article for a really cool magazine in London called The Backstory, and they're releasing their issue in January, where I interviewed seven different people in publishing specifically related to ghostwriting. So seven different ghostwriters, agents, or editors of ghostwriters. And that was a really fun article to write. So I've done a lot of freelancing, and I recently started a Substack, really to be able to write more freely and creatively. And that's kind of a satirical, it's pretty new. I only have a few posts up, and I'm still working on it as I can. But that's me kind of combining all of my interests. So I'm writing satirical posts about race and class and specifically whiteness in America. And I write a lot of satirical recipes, which is really fun.
Oh, cool. You really get to express your sense of humor in your writing, both paid and at the moment unpaid.
Yeah, because ghostwriting is capturing someone else's voice. You know, it's hours of interviews and I work with really busy people, so I'm really flexible. So sometimes they answer my questions in a Zoom interview, sometimes they answer my questions over an email, sometimes they'll leave me a WhatsApp memo, and I'm just like, putting together all these different sources of their vision and their voice, and it's a lot of work. It's really fun, and I really enjoy it, but it's not me, and I have to always remember this is someone else's book that I'm just the writer on. And I think as a writer, it's like I have to find ways to express myself, and because I have this very specific and kind of niche way of using my skills as a writer, I wanted my Substack to be as creative and out there as possible. So I was like, what will be fun for me at the end of the day to write? What is something I know about? What is something I listen to podcasts about and I read articles about and I read books about? And for me, that's, as we've kind of talked about, it's culture and race and class and who I am in this, vast and diverse world. And I want it to be fun. I want it to be enjoyable for me and the reader. And so that's why I kind of chose the satirical tone.
So I did the math, and it sounds like you and your husband work about 50 hours a week combined on average. And that's probably what one busy partner would be doing back in the US in
Right.
order to pay the bills. So it sounds like you two have some nice flexibility built into your lives. What does your income look like? Are you able to, maybe you can just answer that broadly first. Like, are you able to live comfortably where you are in Mexico and still be able to like go back to the US and save money
Yeah.
for the future? And how does it compare to what you were earning when you both had your other jobs based in the US or when you were living abroad?
Yeah, so I'm really happy to just talk like real hard
Oh,
numbers
please
because I
do.
feel like, I just feel like when we make money shameful and secret, it's like capitalism wins and nobody advances and we're all just stuck in our own shame spirals. So, as a public school teacher with some experience in the US, I think he was making about 50,000 a year and I was making like 47 or 48 a year. I also worked every summer to supplement that income. And this was before a kid. Like just, because kids are a whole other, can of worms, can of wiggly toddler worms. So yeah, before a kid, it was like we were combined making over $100,000 a year living in Austin, which at the time, this is like 6, 7 years ago, we were very comfortable. We did not live in this cool neighborhoods of the city, but we lived within driving distance. We each had a car. I lived in a 2-1 duplex before we got together, but it was on a creek and there was this incredible view and I could hike off leash with my dog every day. And, we were comfortable. And then when we went to, but at time there were tight months. I mean, we couldn't really travel. It was hard to travel internationally at that point, unless we were doing it on a very tight budget. So we were wanting more out of our life in Austin and we were just kind of making it. And then that's part of why we decided to go ahead and travel abroad and go study abroad. So study abroad, sorry, teach abroad. And then when we were in Uzbekistan, we were basically making the same salaries that we were making in the US, but it's the cost of living there is half or even less. So when we went to Uzbekistan, he was still making around 40 or 42 a year. And I just worked part-time because I was working on my novel. I was working on a young adult novel at the time. So I guess I was making 20-ish a year. I was teaching one class online for a university. So maybe I was making like 25 or 28 a year. And we were very comfortable in Uzbekistan. Now, at the same time, the pandemic happened and we were stuck in Uzbekistan. There was no flights in or out for like 9 months or 10 months. So there was other challenges of living there. And we also didn't speak Russian or Uzbek, which are the two main languages there. So there wasn't really a lot for us to do. So it was easy to save money a lot of the time. So that was our life in Uzbekistan. Then I got pregnant and we were, surprised, happy, happy surprise. But I did not want to have the baby in Uzbekistan because between the two of us, we had had a number of bad experiences with medical care. I think most Uzbeks would admit that they struggle with the medical system there too. So we came back to have the baby. And my husband had invested in a house with his brother. And it was the house Tim and I had been living in before we went to Uzbekistan. They just had a renter. But then we came back and the housing bubble or whatever like exploded. And after the pandemic, everybody was trying to buy a house. David sold his share of the house. And so that gave us this chunk of money that we paid for a wedding, basically, the two of us for ourselves. We paid for a home birth for our child, and we paid for a lot of doulas and midwives and support with that. And then we bought another house after that. So he's out of that house, and then him and I own a house together in Austin. Things seemed okay. Like I was kind of working part-time. I was taking care of the first year I took care of my baby most of the time. I had sitters come, mostly good friends come a couple mornings a week to help, but I was doing most of the childcare and, teaching a few classes online and doing a little bit of writing. But once it was time to put her in daycare, like we found this lovely little Spanish immersion Montessori preschool that was $1,300 a month, and that was a cheaper school in Austin. I mean, and it's
Whoa.
only those hours. I mean, I think we dropped her off at, I think drop off was between 8 or 9 in the morning, and you pick up by 3. So it's not even a full day of work. Like most people work till 5 or 6. So I had to continue working part time to be available for my child. And my husband was feeling the pressure of like, okay, like he was teaching at a Waldorf school. He loved it. He was doing some IT work for them, but it wasn't enough. And I think at that time he was making, I don't know, $65,000, $70,000 a year. I was probably making similarly 28, something around maybe 30. And but we owned a house and we were just getting pinched more and more. And we were starting to kind of buy into this mentality that we've resisted our whole lives, which is like, we can't leave. We just have to make more money. We just have to make more money. So he left this job that he loved with people that he loved, a deep sense of fulfillment. He left to go get a corporate job doing tech in the tech industry. And he did that for a year. And at first, I wouldn't say he was miserable at first. I would say he was okay. He wasn't happy, but he was okay. And then the company's culture changed and he got miserable. And after a year, they laid him off. And as I mentioned before, in our careers as teachers, we were like teacher of the year, teacher of the month. We were being featured. I mean, we were
You
beloved
were
and very well
loved.
respected. Yes, we were. So the fact that he was laid off for the first time in his life, it was devastating. And I think it was really a struggle. And we were so pinched at the time that once he was laid off, we knew we only had a few months to figure out what we were going to do because we didn't really have that much savings. And that's how we decided to move to Mexico.
How old was your daughter at that point?
So she turned 2 in December. My husband went in January and I went in February. So she just turned 2.
Okay, so you're about 1 year into this living abroad experiment.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And okay, so we're going to talk about Mexico and your decision to live there. I'm really happy that you shared all those financials. Just give me the short answer. When you moved to Mexico, did everything get better?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Financially, how did things change?
Well, our living expenses went down by about half. So in Austin, my husband's big into numbers. So we would do these monthly spreadsheets. It was this whole thing. So in Austin, we were spending about $10,000 a month. And we had a 2-1 house. Okay, sorry, so a 3-2 house, 2 bathrooms, 3-bedroom house at the very edge of Austin. And when I say the edge, I mean the house behind me was no longer in the city of Austin. They didn't have trash service. They were technically only in the county. So like we literally could not have been pushed farther out of Austin and still be in Austin. So we were spending about $10,000 a month and on childcare and, groceries. And he had to have a car because he was going all the way into downtown every day to work. And I had a car because I had a baby I had to take care of all the time. And, it was just, it was a lot. And we would look at our friends and we would be like, how are you people doing this? Like, we were used to living on half that in Austin 5, 6 years ago. And so, but when we got to Mexico, all that went down. I mean, we're between $5,000 and $6,000 a month. And, we have two dogs, a toddler, and the both of us work. Both of us work, not full time, obviously. But the biggest thing that changed was childcare. To get high quality childcare in Austin, it was about $25 an hour for a babysitter. And then I told you, like, our preschool was $1,300 a month, and it didn't even last the full day. And then we came to Mexico and we have this incredible babysitter. I mean, a babysitter is just like not even the word for this woman who's like a caring, loving, brilliant, artist, creative, part of our family. I mean, she has a degree and she's this incredible, talented artist herself. She comes 4 afternoons a week. So my kid goes to a preschool in the morning. That's, I think we pay $250 or $300 a month for that. And it's kind of like an international school, but it's small. It's in a woman's house in our neighborhood. We get to walk to school every day, which is like magical. And so every morning she's at her little preschool. She comes home, we put her down for a nap here, and then our lovely Ninietta comes in the most afternoons and they make art together and they go on walks. I mean, I came home yesterday, or was it yesterday or 2 days ago? And the babysitter and my daughter had made flower crowns. They had gone to some park or empty lot in our neighborhood, picked a bunch of flowers, brought them home, and woven them into these beautiful flower crowns. And I'm just like, I just can't pay for that stuff. I don't know. It just seems so intangibly special.
Okay, it sounds like everything is definitely better in Mexico. Tell me, as someone who's lived abroad quite a bit and in lower income countries, what's your relationship to moving someplace where the cost of living is lower and bringing your US income there? What feelings come up for you around this?
Yeah, that's a really important question that I hope a lot of people ask themselves. And I'll say, I'm just going to shout out to an author and a teacher who has really, her book has shaped a lot of my thinking around this. It just came out recently, Airplane Mode and Irreverent History of Travel, by Shahnaz Habib. Her book, I just think for anybody who wants to travel to any degree, you should read it because it puts the history of colonization in context of expat travel, which I just haven't read something so easily digestible that does that. So it's complicated. I mean, it's a really complicated experience. And I think a lot of Americans don't really acknowledge or talk about that aspect of living abroad. I just wrote an article for this kind of like a travel guide that's coming out specifically for women who want to move to Mexico. And I really like the editor and I like the author. I think she can appreciate and understand these nuanced views. But I think a lot of the other contributors, a lot of the essays are like, everything's so cheap. Move here now. Everything's great and cheap. And it's just not that simple because, okay, for example, I live in a central Mexican mountain town called San Miguel de Allende. It's probably one of the most famous expat destinations in all of Mexico. It's like 70 degrees in the shade every single day. Everything is so verdant. It's so beautiful. It's a colonial town. So, which a lot of people like that description in the sense that the Spanish built the cobblestone roads and a lot of the way that the buildings look are the same way they looked during the Spanish colonization. But a lot of like Mexicans or indigenous, communities in Mexico wouldn't describe a town that they love going to as colonial because that's not really a flavor a favorable description. So I'm in this beautiful place. Me and my husband are able to work remotely. So we bring US dollars to Mexico. And sure, most of my money is spent in Mexico. But because so many expats have moved to San Miguel, a town that was sleepy and quiet, that was really based on agriculture and mining for a long time, is now almost entirely based on tourism. And a lot of people will say, like, that's great. Oh my God, we're bringing all these jobs and we're supporting all these people. And a piece of that is true. But a larger piece that's harder to see is that the culture of this town is fundamentally changed. And instead of people growing up on family farms, intergenerational, processes of, like sustainable food ways and learning about indigenous techniques. It's like now they're all opening restaurants catered to Americans, or they're starting tours. It's just like there's a piece of the culture that's lost because we're here.
Yeah, most tourists are not that interested in indigenous techniques, but they're very interested in avocado toast that costs one third what it would back home. And that's reality.
Yeah, and I'm not separate from that. I can't put myself on a pedestal and say I'm different because I came here in a financial crisis. My husband was laid off. We were seriously considering moving into the attic, my in-laws' attic with a toddler and two dogs. So I wouldn't have moved to Belgium, for example, in that situation, but at the same time, like I struggle with that. I do. I struggle with that. And we have a housekeeper here. I in the States, I can't even imagine having a housekeeper. Like I mean, I was a teacher my whole life, so we are always middle class. But it's incredible because when I have help with my daughter and help maintaining my household, I can work. And when I mean work, I don't just mean earn money. I mean do my life's work, the work that feeds me as a person. And I know I can do that because I have the help of these two women who I see almost every day. So I value that,
When we spoke previously, you told me that by living in Mexico, not only can you speak the Spanish that you already know how to speak, but your daughter can learn how to speak Spanish. You can escape the heat of the Texas summers, which is just way too much, that there's a nice integrated expat community where you can actually make friends, and that the Texas that you know was going in a direction politically that you were not interested in anymore, aside from just the basic getting priced out of Austin. So it sounds
That's
like you
right.
really have found a mecca and a subculture that enables you not just to be a better parent, a more relaxed partner, and to do your life's work, but to also have friends and just feel less stressed. Like, why not recommend this to other people who might feel like they're in a similar challenging situation to you?
Oh, what a great question. God. I mean, there's an entire industry built up around convincing Americans to move to Mexico. I mean, all you have to do is Google like expat guides in Mexico, and there's just tons of YouTube channels and newsletters and, relocation services. And I think it makes me uncomfortable because it's a kind of exploitation, And I say this because this is how I felt in Austin. I was in Austin, I was born in Austin. My husband lived his entire life in Austin. I had lived in Austin for almost 20 years with a few breaks here and there. And to me, it was this small, kind of funky, hippie artist town, relatively liberal, still had lots of cultural problems, racism and segregation. That stuff doesn't go away, but I felt I could see myself in this place. I could be a teacher and I could afford to live there. And then when we came back after the pandemic, and there was this huge amount of Californians who, frankly, were fleeing out of control housing prices on the West Coast, moving to Texas. And suddenly I couldn't afford to live in Texas anymore. I couldn't, live on a teacher's salary. I couldn't raise a, I mean, I had been taking care of other people's kids for 20 years, and I suddenly couldn't afford to be in that same place where I'd been helping raise other people's kids and get the help to raise my own kid. So I felt like the culture of my town that I love was changing fundamentally in a way that I could no longer recognize it. And I was being priced out of this place I had lived for such a long time. And Americans and expats moving to a place like San Miguel, the same, it's doing the same thing here. It's like the culture has, Americans have been coming here since the 50s. There was this veteran who started an art school here and convinced a lot of Americans to come here, right? So there has been an American presence here and a general expat presence here for a long time. But the culture here has fundamentally changed. It's moved to relying on tourism. And so even though I can't feel the way it has changed, and I don't feel the same kind of sadness that I know Mexican families who have lived here for 100 years feel, I know what that felt like in Austin. And at the same time, it's like a lot of Mexicans whose families have lived here for a long time also are struggling to afford to stay here, just like I couldn't stay in Austin. So I guess I just feel torn. I mean, I made this imperfect, kind of impossible decision where it was like, where can I go to give my daughter a beautiful childhood? Where can I go where I can still go home and for her to see her grandparents on a regular basis? Where can I go to a culture that I appreciate, I feel welcomed in, but I also respect? Where can I go where I speak the language? Because living in Uzbekistan was tough, and I don't really, I'm tired. I have a 3-year-old. I haven't slept in 3.5 years. So like, I'm not really in a space to like deal with a deep language barrier right now. So I just feel conflicted. I mean, I don't have the answer. I just feel like this is a beautiful place. I do love my life here. It has solved for now a lot of problems. But I can't deny that a lot of the people who live here don't necessarily appreciate and respect Americans' role in this part of Mexico.
It seems like you've identified at least one absolutely true thing, Kelsey, which is that we can blame the Californians. It all starts there. I'm part of the problem, I admit it. So,
Understand them too, man.
you have a lot of positive things to say about living in Mexico and San Miguel. What feels like it's still up in the air or unsustainable or might be the thing that pushes you elsewhere?
Yeah, I was thinking about that question in particular. Well, I mean, you probably experienced this living abroad. I'm sure a lot of people have. There is a level of difficulty living abroad that you sort of, it's sort of the price of the living abroad is like high highs and low lows. So when I've it, definitely in Mexico, I mean, even just this morning, I took my daughter to the Placita, this weekly market that happens. And, you know, we were like, she's 3, so I'm always like, are you going to pee your pants? Like, at what point do I have to like squat on the side of the road and make you pee? So I'm a little bit nervous about like, if I push her too far, are you getting tired? And we're like winding through all these little stalls and tienditas, and you know, there's like these huge stacks of chicharrón, like pig skins, fried pig skins, just stacked super high. And we're walking by grills that are covered by these gigantic agave leaves, and they like barbecue meat on top of it. And I'm like winding my way through, and I'm trying to find this drink called pulque, which is it's been drunk here for millennia. I mean, it's a pre-colonization indigenous creation, fermented drink out of the agave plant. And somebody brought it to my birthday last week, and I thought, oh, I'll get some while I'm here. But I have no idea where to get it. And so I'm asking all these vendors, do I get it here? I'm carrying my 35-pound 3-year-old, and I'm like, you know, it's like sweaty, and I'm like, oh, I don't know where to go. I can't find it. And I finally get to the pulque stand, and I'm talking to the woman, and this old man walks up and you know, squats down next to my daughter and puts down this basket just full of marigolds, which they grow here and put all around the city for Dia de los Muertos. And there's this huge basket of marigolds, and he tells her in Spanish, pick one, pick one. And she looks at me kind of nervously, and I said, it's okay, go ahead. So she picked out one marigold. And he starts talking to her and saying, how old are you? What's your name? And she's speaking to him in perfect Spanish. And you know, it's this moment of like, despite the stress of being in the market and the stress of having a toddler, and you know, I'm tired, I haven't been sleeping a lot because she hasn't been sleeping a lot. It was just this like beautiful moment where I was like, my kid was speaking Spanish, there's beautiful flowers, I have this drink you can really only drink in Central Mexico. And I just, that's one of those high highs, you know? And so I think I sometimes, 2 days ago, we were changing the sheet in my bedroom, and there was a freaking scorpion in the middle of my sheet. I'm like, the desert will kill you, you know? And so this is what I'm saying. It's like sometimes I feel like it can be too hard. You know, there's street dogs that are limping out my door, and there's a freaking scorpion in my bed, and the plumber's 3 hours late, and my empleada, the woman who helps us in our house, she didn't understand what I told her. And I feel like, oh my God, it's too hard. I can't do it. But then I have these beautiful experiences with the culture here, with people here, with food here, where I'm like, God, this is so special. This is so cool that I get to be here and experience this.
I want to circle back to where we started talking about expats and how you, early in living abroad, you didn't feel like you identified with other expats and you didn't share the same values, didn't really understand them, didn't really want to hang out with them. How do
Yeah.
you avoid becoming one of those people yourself? What are you trying to keep in mind in order to not, go full circle?
Oh man. Yeah, God, the biggest thing is that I have to admit that I am one of them. Like I'm not better than other Americans who are here, Like I have to admit that I'm one of the weirdos. I do. And but I do think I think it's important to learn about Mexico in this example from Mexicans. And I'm not saying you can't, you can only come here if you're fluent in Spanish. I would never tell somebody from Mexico that could only come to the States if they were fluent in English. It's not really about that. There's plenty of people here who are interested in talking to foreigners and have a lot to say and who speak English or good enough English or whatever. So I just think it's important to like be humble, to be quiet. Oh my God, trying to get an American expat to be quiet is just like feels like an impossible task. Like if you can just sit at a cafe or sit at a restaurant or sit at a bar on a stool in the market and be fucking quiet and
Not be
listen to the people
noisy.
around you,
Yeah.
yeah, and not tell everybody what you like, but just sit there and observe and listen, or not tell everybody what your state is like or your city, but listen to them talk about theirs. I just feel like you have to come here and admit your ignorance and admit your smallness, because in the States we've been told our whole lives that we're from the best country in the world and we're the biggest and the baddest and the smartest and the richest and it's just not true. Like there's so many things we get wrong and so many things other places and other people get right. But if we can be quiet and listen and allow the place you're in to change you and get into your heart and get into your soul and get into your work, it makes the world better.
And how do you remind yourself to do this in your day-to-day life? Is there any specific moments you can think of where you had an impulse to act a certain way that might have led you in the direction of the loud, self-centered expat or tourist, and you took the other way?
I think that maybe this is obvious, but I do. I feel that I complain about Americans doing this, and I feel the urge to do it all the time. There is the stuff about money, the stuff about prices. A lot of Americans, especially when they first get here, talk a lot about how cheap it is here. And I told you, I came here in a personal financial crisis, and just living here. And San Miguel is a pretty expensive city within Mexico. I still cut my living expenses in half. And there are times when we're out somewhere with my yesterday we were in a store. Some of our pans have been ruined. We just moved houses and we were going to get some new pans. And he was saying really loudly in the store how cheap the pans were. And I found myself shushing him. And I was like, David, shh, stop. Like, I get it. I know. And I feel that there are times when I'm so grateful that it's cheaper for me here. I'm so grateful that I can afford childcare without being stressed, like I know that's a function of, working remotely, earning US dollars. I know that's a function of colonization. I know that's a function of political happenings and mechanisms between these two countries. Some of that stuff is way bigger than me, and some of it is I'm involved with it in ways I don't even know. But I really think if there's like one big things I could tell other Americans, it's like stop talking about how cheap everything is in front of Mexicans because it's not cheap for Mexicans, especially in this city. It's everything is expensive here for locals, for people who are from here. And then for us, it's cheap. And so I'm not saying you can't have those conversations or those thoughts. I just feel like that's a private conversation with other expats. That's not something you want to flaunt in front of people who are struggling to make it in the place that they're from.
Yeah, I completely agree. Kelsey, if anyone wants to follow your writing online, especially your new Substack, where can they find you?
Yeah, so my website has all the things. That's just my name, kelseyshipman.com. It has information about ghostwriting. It has a lot of my freelancing articles. It has links to my Instagram, which I update regularly. And my Substack, it's called White People School.
Wow, that's direct.
I mean, after an hour of talking to me, is it surprising? Yeah. So it's called White People School, and I'm still once a week, I try to get something up. So it's pretty small right now, but I'm gonna keep building it. But I would love for people to check it out and leave me comments and tell me what they like and what they hate. I can take it all.
And if someone wants to find out more specifically about your experience living abroad with a young child, a lot of the stuff we've been discussing in this interview, can they also find that through your website?
Yeah, I think Instagram is probably the best place for that because I post a lot about what it's like to be a mom, to be an American mom living in Mexico. I post links to all my articles. So I would say my Instagram, which is my name at kelseyaaronshipman.com. That's a good hub for everything.
Awesome. Kelsey, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Blake. Thanks for listening and letting me just rant and rant and rant. See, I'm so American.